Welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast, episode 67, Princeton. Well, we're back. It's been a few weeks, but we're back, and I'm ready to get things going. I want to wish everyone a happy Martin Luther King Day, and I want to thank everyone for their patience. I know I said I would be back sooner than I was, but of course, work and school never line up. I think what I'm going to do from now on is I'm just not going to tell you guys when I'm going to be back. I'm just going to surprise you with a new episode. It's going to be like a Christmas present. You just never know what you're going to get. You'll be like, oh, look, a new episode's out. Fantastic. This way you guys aren't, you know, oh, you said he'd be back next week, but he's not here. It's very difficult and frustrating, I completely understand. And other podcasts are out there that are on this, you know, we can do an episode a week schedule. And I wish I could do that. Unfortunately, the problem was that early on, I built up a lot of episodes, but my time constraints kind of forced me to go through those quickly without having more episodes researched to follow up. And anytime I do get a large amount of episodes researched and laid out, I unfortunately am stuck in the situation that, well, we have, you know, I've got these episodes, and so I give myself a little bit of time, and all of a sudden, boom, I run through those episodes too. So from now on, I'm just not going to tell you guys when I'm putting out episodes. I'm going to try my best to, you know, do them as often as I can, keeping to, at the very least, at the maximum, a policy of an episode a week, and at the very least, hopefully every 3 weeks. I know that doesn't sound fantastic, but luckily I keep seeing all the time more and more likes on the Facebook, so that's really a stroke of my ego, for one. And two, it lets me know that people are out there listening. So even though you may not always be, I may not always be on point with my episodes, you guys will always be there listening to the episodes. So I appreciate that, and I think that is really kind of everyone to be so understanding. Remember, I don't do this for money. I do this for just the sheer fact that I love the American Revolution and I love talking about history. And that's what we're going to do today. We're going to talk about the Battle of Princeton. Where we left off was Trenton. Trenton concludes Washington brings his men back across the river. He has captured a bunch of Hessians, but now he's in a sticky situation. He did it right before the end of the year. And at the end of the year, a bunch of his troops are going to be gone. So what's he going to do? Well, he gets on the horn, or he sends a letter to people in Philadelphia, says, I need money. I need something to hold these troops in place. And he gets some paper money and a guarantee that more will be on the way. He asks his men for $10, something that we scoff at because we spend more of that at Starbucks every day. But for $10, that was a lot of money. That was a week's worth of pay for some of these men. Give me 6 weeks, and then you can head home for $10. And a lot of men take it. Washington has 5,000 men. Men from his old army, Pennsylvania associators, militia. We're going to talk about the breakdown in a minute. But when we look at the Battle of Trenton, I spent a lot of time just focusing on Washington. But remember that I said there were two other wings. They never made the crossing. So what happens? Cadwalder goes to make the crossing, but the ice made it difficult, he was concerned that he wouldn't be able to get his artillery across. So he sends word to Washington. I regret to inform you, Commander, but I can't get my men across. I can't get my artillery across. Washington responds that, you know, that's unfortunate. Ewing didn't even bother to cross. So Washington had to do it on his own. But when Cadwalder heard the guns, he said, no, I'm not leaving the commander on his own. He crosses. He gets to Burlington. No Hessians. They're gone. They're in the wind. He sends Colonel Reed to check out Bordentown. Empty as well. Colonel Reed, after Washington moves back across the river, is scouting the areas around Trenton to see what any elements of the army left around. He writes to Washington, there's no British or Hessians in the area. Come back across. Follow up your victory. Well, Washington would recross, but it would take 2 days. And so by the day before the turn of a new year, Washington is in Trenton. It took time, but he got his men there. But it's about this time that the advanced troops are reporting to Cornwallis and are reporting back in to Cadwalader in Washington that Cornwallis and Grant have 8,000 troops with a large train of artillery, and they're heading south. They're going to be meeting up at Princeton, which was only 12 miles away. So Washington is on the wrong side of the river with 5,000 men. Cornwallis outnumbers him, outguns him. To make matters worse, Washington's force is mostly untrained soldiers and untested militia. Cornwallis's plan is to march to Trenton with 5,500 men. He's going to take on Washington himself. He leaves behind three regiments of the 4th Brigade under Lieutenant Colonel Charles Mawhood at Princeton, about 1,200 men in total, and the entire 2nd Brigade under General Leslie at Maidenhead, another 1,200 men or so. And Cornwallis sets out with his division and 28 guns of various calibers on January 2nd. Now, the plan was to meet Washington in Trenton and erase his army from the field. Then they would be pretty much done with the Patriot threat. Washington knew that Cornwallis was coming to Trenton, so he ordered General Roche de Fermoy with his own brigade, Colonel Hand's Pennsylvania Rifleman, and Colonel Haussegger's German battalion, which was a brand new battalion, and Colonel Charles Scott's Virginia Continentals, along with Colonel Forrest's two-gun battery. A lot of players in the field here, but he sends them north. This was about 1,000 or so men he sent forward, and their job is to just block up the road, cause a little stress and havoc on the advance guard of Cornwallis's army, so that Washington can better prepare his position. But then Fermoy returns to Trenton in what is said as a very questionable circumstances. No idea why he returns. But Colonel Hand is left in charge of all the troops. And as Cornwallis's advance units, which was about 1,500 men, hit the Americans, they were met with concentrated and deadly fire. Hand knew that this was only the advance, and soon he would be outgunned and outmatched. So he organizes a slow retreat. The whole way back to Trenton, whenever the Patriots would find an area that was in their best interest, that they could take advantage of, they would set up and continue to fire into the British. At one point, the firing was so hot that two German regiments were brought up because they thought they were in a general engagement. Well, the Americans make it back to Trenton. Though they were closely followed by the British advance guard, the advance guard is once again held up by Patriots that were spread out throughout the town, taking shots at them from behind buildings, fences, windows, wherever. Doesn't matter. But they're taking shots at the advance guard and once again holding them up. So Hand is able to get his men to the south side of the Assunpink Creek, where Washington has set up a defensive position with cannon. Though Hand had done well holding up the British advance, the problem was that the main body was still coming down the road. The weather, which was holding Cornwallis up originally, was not going to hold him up indefinitely. It wouldn't be until about 5 p.m. on the afternoon of the 2nd that the British would make their first attempt at Washington's position. Even with the failing light, the Americans were able to hold the bridge that crossed the creek. That, remember, this is the area that Ewing was supposed to take control of during the Battle of Trenton episode. Well, they're holding up the bridge pretty well, and the Hessians tried to ford down creek, but they run into Hitchcock's Rhode Island Continentals, and so they're pushed back. When Cornwallis finally arrives with the main army, he takes up a council. Sir William Erskine urged Cornwallis to attack immediately. It doesn't matter that it's dark, attack immediately. His rationale is, if Washington is the general that I take him to be, he will not be found there in the morning. But others thought, well, he's between the Assunpink, our position, and the Delaware is on his back. Where are the Americans going? Well, of course, they were 100% wrong. Washington's position looked like it would be strong, but if there's anything that Cornwallis isn't, is that he's overly cautious. So Washington knows that I'm in my position. It looks like it's pretty good. But the problem is that if any great number of troop is thrown at us, we're not going to be able to hold this position. And he knows that Cornwallis isn't a cautious man. He's going to send as many men over that. They're going to send him over the bridge. He's going to ford the creek. The Assunpink is not a big creek, so it's easily fordable. He's going to be sending men over. Plus, they're going to be cannonading from inside town. They may not do a lot of damage with the cannon, but it's going to keep their heads down at least long enough for the troops to get in a position. So, Washington has to make a move. Well, Washington had always planned to go after New Brunswick. You see, the British line is set up in a long line. New Brunswick, then to Burlington, Princeton, Trenton. It's a long line. If you break any portion of that line, the troops that are on the wrong side of that break have no way of getting back to British lines outside of taking to the woods, but they're going to lose all of their supplies in the process. So the major advantage for Washington would be to get north, take New Brunswick. All the troops in Jersey would be at his will, and that could turn New Jersey back in favor of the Americans. So his first plan was to head for Princeton. He's going to move around Cornwallis' left flank, bypass Cornwallis completely. Then he's going to move his men on a different road, way past Maidenhead, and move up into Princeton and attack it directly. Then from there, move up to New Brunswick. While all of this is going on, a party of about 400 men were chosen to work the position, so it sounded like the Americans were still there. And they would build up the campfire so the British couldn't see what was going on. No one under the rank of general in the American army knew what Washington was planning, and he kept it that way. So at 1 a.m. on January 3rd, Washington and his men were underway to Princeton. Now, the force at Princeton, I had said, was three regiments, the 17th, the 40th, and the 55th, along with three troops of light dragoons under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Charles Mawhood. Mawhood had orders of his own. You see, he was supposed to head out on the 3rd, as per Cornwallis's orders, head down to Maidenhead, and join him at Trenton as a reserve force in case they had any trouble with the Americans. The 40th was going to remain in Princeton to guard all of the supplies. Cornwallis thinks that he has Washington over a barrel. He doesn't realize that Washington's already on the move. So, as per his orders, early the next morning, Mawhood is out underway, and he's heading south. Well, he catches a glimpse of a body of troops moving north. Not believing that they could be an attacking force, he sent mounted officers to investigate. Maybe Cornwallis already defeated Washington. Maybe these are prisoners. Or maybe they're some of Cornwallis' troops returning. He doesn't know. He sends two mounted officers, but they come back and say, no, these are the Americans. And Mawhood orders his men to fall back to Princeton. Now, there's a strong position just outside town on top of a hill. It's from there that Mawhood is going to set up his defense. He's going to be able to execute a good defense of the town by putting cannon and having troops a good strong position to move and attack Washington's force if they attack the town directly. Or if they attack Mawhood to make sure that his force is out of the way, and you know, then he would be in a strong position there as well. Well, that's when the race for the high ground begins, because Mawhood is going to move his men to this ridge. The problem is Mercer, who's in the advance guard, is already underway, and Mercer is a lot closer to that ridge than Mawhood. So Mercer gets to the high ground first, just before Mawhood. Mawhood sends his men right up the hill, right at Mercer's troops. And when with both troops deployed, they open fire on each other at the same time. But Mawhood was aggressive. He opens a volley and then follows up his volley with bayonets. Mercer's men were in the van. They were on their own until Washington would arrive with the rest of his forces. And the sight of bayonets, well, it scared the troops. And they began to retreat. Mercer and his officers try to rally, but Mercer is stabbed 7 times by bayonets and left for dead. Go figure. John Hazlitt, who was commander of the Delaware, the 1st Delaware Regiment, before they had returned home, stayed with the Army. Okay, so he's an independent officer without a regiment. He stayed with the Army. Well, he's trying to rally some of those troops. And he got some of them rallied, but then he's shot in the head and killed. So Hazlitt's dead. Morehead pursued the Americans to the top of another ridge, but was pushed back because Cadwalder associates are next on the scene. Cadwalder pushed forward, and the British were in a low point between the ridge that Mercer had occupied and this new ridge that the Americans had fallen back to. And the British were in a little low point between the two ridges. Now, on top of the ridge that Mercer had occupied, the British now had cannon. And as Cadwalder sent his men against Morehead, it was actually a pretty strong position. They were behind a fence in a low cut. It gave the British pretty good protection. So as the associates come down with the cannon and the muskets, they're driven back. But the Americans are still milling at the top of this hill. But they're all disorganized. So when Washington arrives with Sullivan's troops were going to head to attack Princeton. Washington, hearing what's going on over on the other side of town, or just outside of town, heads off to see what the situation is, and actually tries to rally the troops. He gets on the scene, he sees the associators, and he sees Mercer's men, and they're all disorganized, they're all milling about, they don't know what to do, they have no idea. Washington takes his hat off, rallies his men, says, "Men, join with me." He's trying to get the men moving, and the whole time he's doing this, he's 40 yards from Morehead's front line. 40 yards. And I've talked about the inaccuracy of muskets, but at 40 yards, they'll hit something. And at that point, a volley is unleashed. And when the smoke clears, Washington is still there at the top of the ridge. He's still standing. He's sitting. He's on his horse. His horse is unscathed. He's unscathed. And then Hitchcock Rhode Islanders come on the scene. Hands, Pennsylvania riflemen, the 7th Virginia, all come forward. And the Cadwalders and Mercer's men were moments ago looking like they were defeated, are renewed, and they charge into the fight. American batteries are rolling into positions. At last, the retreating troops are reformed and led by the Virginians, and they're coming up to the batteries post firing by platoons as they advanced. Hand's riflemen went against Morehead's right, and St. Clair's corps attacked the rest of the British 55th, now coming up to support part of their regiment that had marched with Morehead. The Americans advanced on quickly. They were firing heavily into Morehead's position, and the 55th, who was trying to support those that were moving with Morehead, were pushed back. And the 40th was pushed back, trying to get to the support of Morehead. They end up being pushed back into Princeton, and they're cut off. But gallant Morehead had no thought of surrender. He ordered a charge with bayonet, broke through the swarm of Americans on the main road, crossed the bridge, and began his rapid retreat to Trenton, the dragoons covering his rear. Washington, with a troop of Philadelphia Light Horse, led the pursuit, following by many of his men on foot. The retreating British at first maintained good order, but finally broke, scattered away from the road, with the American infantry after them. Many were shot down, 50 were captured. The fields were littered with their muskets, accoutrements, everything being thrown away in the retreat. The only reason the pursuit stopped is that the British goons decided that they were going to have a last stand themselves, but were eventually retreated from the field as well. Back in Princeton, the 40th Regiment, with the men of the 55th who had not joined Morehead, were driven back into the town. Part of them fled towards New Brunswick. The rest took refuge in Nassau Hall. It was surrounded. Captain Alexander Hamilton fired one ball from his field piece into it, and a party of Jerseymen entered it. A surrender was inevitable. 194 prisoners were taken. The actual battle near the bridge lasted only 15 minutes. But it was very hot combat and fought at close quarters. In a short time, 40 Americans were killed and wounded. Among the dead were General Mercer, who succumbed to his wounds of 7 bayonet stabs, I'm just saying. Colonel Hazlitt were some of the key officers that were killed, along with 9 others. Lower ranks, captains, lieutenants, ensigns, so on and so forth. Washington estimates that the British lost 400. 100 were killed in the field. The rest were taken prisoner. Howe's official report showed that there were 18 killed, 58 wounded, and 187 missing. As usual, the two claims cannot be reconciled, so we really can't determine which was which. My assumption is that a lot of them took to the field, went down the road, scattered, and then found their way back to Trenton. But still, the 194 were definitely captured, plus whoever was captured on the retreat, which was about 50, so that's 250. And I don't know if 100 were killed, but a 400 seems like a plausible number. Howe's number, on the other hand, a lot less plausible. Besides the dead, the Americans took 2 brass guns, whatever horses that were still left alive, blankets, shoes, and other things for transportation, along with whatever stores were in the town of Princeton. So it's a good day for the Americans. Don't forget, they're also probably picking up a lot of the British muskets that were left by the dead and captured. So, all in all, it turns out to be a good day. And like Trenton, this battle really lights a fire underneath the American cause. But he couldn't follow up his victory with a march onto New Brunswick. It would be too risky. There's no doubt that with Leslie in Maidenhead and Cornwallis down in Trenton, they were going to be heading back north. They were going to be looking to get to Princeton to help Mulhood out and to chase after Washington. So what's Washington going to do? Well, he's going to actually head west. He's going to head to a small country town called Morristown. And there he's going to set up winter quarters. A couple of days after the battle at Princeton, American contingents will also take the towns of Hackensack and Elizabethtown. Washington had swept Jersey clear of any of the enemy except for Amboy and New Brunswick, which Howe still held with about 5,000 men each. But they were posts that, unless a sizable army was there to reinforce them, they weren't going to be marching out against Washington anytime soon. And Howe undoubtedly would not risk any large group of troops to push them out of winter quarters and risk them in the field in the dead of winter. So that will pretty much solidify things for both armies for the campaign season of 1776. We're just going to ignore that the New Jersey portion of the 76 campaign season overlapped into 1777 by a few days. That's the Battle of Princeton. It's a bit of a bloody affair. It's a rousing victory for Washington, and it's a bit of a shocker to Cornwallis, who will actually end up moving back up to New Brunswick and eventually moving his men into winter quarters in New York City. He got out-duped again by Washington, so he, needless to say, was a little bit shocked and, you know, a little bit dismayed at the outcome of these few days in New Jersey. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Where we're moving on to next is we're going to spend a little time talk about the 77 winter. And then from there, we move on into the 77 campaign season and start talking about what the heck is happening. It's, you know, really unique. I wanted to get to talking about things in the revolution quickly, and I didn't want to spend a lot of time working political angles, but of course I do. And I had the idea early on, let's talk about some of the key players, which I did a little bit, but I've moved away from that recently. I might get back to that in the near future, but it's just unique that it's been almost 3 years since I started this project, and I'm 67. I'm on the 67th episode, and I've only gotten through the first full campaign season because, you know, we start 1775 is a bit of an awkward year. It's not until basically December of 75 that the 76 campaign season really starts. And we've covered quite a few battles over long distances. And 77 is just going to be even more of that, more battles, more campaign moves, continuous maneuvering of chess pieces. So 77 is going to see a very different American army facing off with a much more aggressive British army. So, but that we'll talk about in the next episode. I hope everyone has a great week, and I will hopefully be back soon with another episode. Until then, remember, keep that powder dry.